Well, hi, everybody. And now we continue. We're still in the rules for magic on the astral plane. We've done 53 programs so far. And goodness, this was a major undertaking to do Rule 10. But now we're at 11.1. Beginning with the 11th rule. It's not a short one, but then when this is completed, our work on the rules for magic for the astral plane will also be completed. Of course, never completed. One can only maybe say a few things, but will stimulate our understanding, which is very necessary at this time. I've often felt that there is insufficient attention paid to what the Tibetan has written. Of course, I can, you know, judge myself in that respect too. He wrote so much, and it was of great depth. And maybe the last couple of decades have seen a diminishing of attention to the really high quality material and the emergence of many things which are of lesser value. But let's just see. Let's try to move along together and finish this. And then that which remains will be the four rules for the etheric plane. And we'll then, excuse me, include the manifestation of that which is physical. So, three things. This is the rule. And, might as well, you know, make it, have it stand out a bit. Three things the worker with the law, and let's remember that in all of this seventh ray magical process, we are working with laws that cannot be broken, or they will break us, as my old teacher used to say. Three things the worker with the law must now accomplish. First, ascertain the formula which will confine the lives within the ensphering wall. Next, pronounce the words which will tell them what to do and where to carry that which has been made. And finally, utter forth the mystic phrase which will save him from their work. So these are matters of great moment and also concern the welfare of the magician. So we're going to analyze the three sentences and speak of salvation from our thought forms and salvation from death. These will be the subjects for us right now. So analysis of the three sentences. This rule is, as you know, the last of those governing work on the astral plane and the magical task of motivating those thought forms which are to be the expression of some type of energy. Now, that's a very important idea, motivating the thought forms, because you can have a very good thought form, and yet unless the power of aspiration or focused desire accompanies it, it will not be driven forth towards manifestation. So we have to have the reason why the thought form should be applied. We have considered the various energies with which men work and the power a man can wield through building thought forms. We have also seen how We have seen also how a man can manipulate the various grades of matter until the embodied idea has clothed itself with mental matter and with astral matter. Okay, so that, in other words, there's been a, so far, a double clothing. It is therefore a vital entity on the verge of materializing upon the physical plane. That would involve the etheric sheath. Nothing, it should be noted, can now stop its emergence into objectivity except the expressed act of will of its creator, for the form being vitalized by that creator is subject always to his will until he has severed the connection with it by the utterance of the mystic phrase. So at this time, at such a time, he turns the thought form free from the power of his own will. A vital entity. We want, we desire that the thought form will manifest. Of course, it is possible for people to change their mind, you know, and then the thought form will be stopped in its descent into tangible form. We will assume that emergence into effective existence is the decision and the creative work is carried forward. In other words, we assume that the creator wants the creation in process to manifest. All right. It will here be noted that this work is either conscious or unconscious. In other words, we can build thought forms unconsciously, but the true white magician is not doing that. In the unconscious building of thought forms, such as is the case with the average human being, many never produce the desired physical plane effects and fail in their intended purpose. Probably a good thing, too, because such thought forms are not all of them, or probably most of them, in line with the divine plan. You kind of look at the throat center and you see that the average individual has Earth as the ruler of the throat center, and there will be fecundity, but not necessarily alignment with the plan. When Saturn rules, as it does for the disciple, there is more likely to be alignment with the plan. As long, however, as man is animated by selfishness and by hatred, this is a beneficent thing. Otherwise, so many of the spontaneously arising thoughts, and, you know, basically in a way, camomanastic thoughts, are in alignment with his attitude of selfishness and hatred. And if you ever want to see that in action, those thought forms in action, just go to almost any article that has been produced on the various news feeds, and there's place for comment. And the amount of negative energy accumulated in those comments is really something to behold. So this is good that it doesn't happen, and that physical effectiveness for these unconsciously generated thought forms doesn't occur. Fortunately for the human race, few people as yet work in mental matter. Most of them work with astral or desire matter, and these forms are fluidic and changeable and are powerful only through the faculty of persistence. So let's just say generally weaker than those which are created with the assistance of the mind. There is an occult basis for the statement that if one desires a thing for a sufficiently long period of time, one will possess it. So, you know, only through persistence. Okay. Much. Such. Okay. Okay, so, only. I don't know why that is happening. Only through persistence. Should we say continuously applied desire, will these desire forms last? So such is the law governing the return to incarnation of the average human being. Lacking the one-pointedness of the mental plane, matter, as it is influenced by the concentrated mind, these desire forms fail to do the damage they otherwise might. So, let's just say, you know, in general here, less power in desire forms than in thought forms, generally. Their effect is felt largely by the creator of these kama monastic forms and not by his environing associates. Not sure where I am now. We can say that he somewhat stews in his persistent desires, and of course it can cause unhealthy conditions within his own energy system. The moment that the mind factor enters and becomes dominant, that moment a man becomes dangerous or useful, as the case may be. Dangerous not only to himself, but to those around him, or useful in the working out of the plan of evolution. So, mind is powerful, and it's been said somewhere that you just can't even destroy that which has been created by the mind. I think Moria emphasizes that, but I think also the destruction of thought forms before they wreak havoc on the surroundings and the individual is also possible. He can then create thought forms capable of producing outward manifesting results and tangible effects. And we might say, not only guided by the Creator, but on their own as well. Given aspiration, however, and spiritual impulse, so the upward tending desire, aspiration, and spiritual impulse, a man can become a true occultist and produce organized results and functioning organisms upon the physical plane. He uses that word organism. He talks about the Masonic organism, the church organism, the banded esoteric organisms. That's the many sort of educational esoteric groups. I use the word organism deliberately, for it will serve to convey the idea that any thought form is regarded by us as a subjective and existing entity clothed in subtle matter and capable of manifestation. And the us, I suppose, indicates the initiates and the masters. Okay. So, So let us continue. So this is popularly sometimes called the working out of an idea or the carrying through of a project. It is termed at other times a discovery or an invention or something of that nature. All the time, quite unrealizing it, man is taking in occult or talking in occult terms and experiencing an inner appreciation of the methods whereby all that has been thought by God or man came into existence. So this again here is more on the creative process, and under some terminology, quite familiar to us, under some. Okay. The embodied idea or thought, the former being potentially far more potent than the latter, and should we say, emanating from the Buddhic plane at the lowest and from other higher planes. The embodied idea or thought has worked its way through to the verge of physical manifestation. Its creator, who in the case of a white magician is not an emotionally centered person, as we say, mental polarization is common and even necessary, which is more than mental focus. The white magician is consciously bringing it to the stage where it, when its inner purpose and plan can be demonstrated. He holds the thought form in his consciousness and gives it shape and energy through the power of his own one-pointed mental focus. This is the work of the white creator. Sometimes these days, you know. Excuse me just for a moment. Right. So we are the creator. We learn how to do this. We are not yet the entirely competent white magician. It only really begins at the third degree, let us say, and continues to grow in power after that. We are told in the rule under consideration that the aspirant has three things to do. Okay. Well, so I think, you know, out of what has just gone on, we say we do not want to be the unconscious mental creator, or kama monastic creator. We want to work deliberately with the qualities of the soul and direct these qualities into expression through the mind, into expression. Some of us have been responsible for, let's say, creating organizations on the physical plane, and we've made mistakes and done some things correctly, and we can measure our process against what is here suggested. We are told in the rule under consideration about these three things. So what are they? Ascertain the formula which will crystallize the form he has built, much in the same way we find architects and bridge builders reducing the desired form to a mathematical formula, which is interesting. Pronounce certain words which will give the form vitality and so carry it forth on the physical plane. This might be called motivating, you know, motivating the motivating certain forces that will carry the form further. And this would just be done in an ordinary sense. But now we're talking about the occult methods. Utter the phrases, or the phrase which will detach the thought form from his aura and so save the drain upon his energies. So this is put in more common language here. We know that if we remain too closely attached to the thought form we are creating, it can indeed prove to be a drain upon our energies. It needs to be out there, and it needs to be shared and pursued by the many rather than just held too close. I think I've mentioned maybe if Beethoven in his Fifth Symphony had never released it and just held it in his studio and not given it to humanity, it would have had probably a terrible effect upon him and would have deprived the world of a great source of inspiration. I guess sometimes I just, you know, think in musical terms about these matters. It will be noted that the formula has relation to the thought form. The words of power to the objective for which it has been created, and let's call that motivation. And the mystic phrase concerns the severing of the magnetic link which binds together the creator and his creation. So I really want to emphasize these three things and find the practical way to work with them in practical creative work. What is this formula? We're told at some point that every advancing initiate has to, at various junctures, offer forth creations. When we hear the word masterpiece, we can think quite strongly of the fifth initiation, and we think about all that Master D.K. did with the Theosophical Society and the working with Alice Bailey and the many books he's written as his masterpiece. And there is something similar, but of lesser degree and intensity, which occurs at the third initiation. The disciple has to offer forth some kind of a formula, some kind of conjecture, some kind of proposal, which will have value to the general manifestation of the plan. It is his formulation of an approach to making the plan more real and more effective. And when it comes to this mystic phrase, well, the great power of detachment is always required. Otherwise, one suffocates. So the power of detachment is desirable and here necessary. One therefore concerns the form, another the soul embodied in the form, whose lowest characteristic is desire, the reflection of love, and the last, the life aspect with which the Creator has endowed the creation. So everything is orderly here, and we understand the sort of the ever-repeated 1, 2, 3 of some of these processes. The formula concerns the thought form, the words of power concerns the soul embodied in the form, so they are vitalized with animated by a desire to see them manifest, and others too will carry forth that desire, maybe those surrounding the Creator. And the last, to decide upon life-giving, upon the independence of the entity which is being created. So the last phrase is life, life-giving, and provides the independence needed by the entity being created by the Creator. Okay. We are consequently face to face again, with the eternal triplicities of spirit, soul, and body. And of course, so often he repeats these very things. It should be remembered that the, we're not in the hermit's cave meditating for our whole life here, so there's lots of little items that come up. But anyway, always the triplicities, which DK repeats and which we see here, he has always an underlying structure. And if you examine closely how he lays things out, there's frequently a numerical basis for it and a solidity of structure. So we're facing the eternal triplicities of spirit, soul, and body. It should be remembered that the rules for magic, as understood by the true esotericist, are as true of a created universe. So, in this case, the term universe is not the grand totality. Solar system or planet, maybe a universe, you know. Possibly. I'm so sorry. Well, it's all about communication, you know. In any case, the term universe can mean a galaxy in this particular case. And in a way, this was written before a lot of galactic theory came into focus and before the discovery of the immense number of galaxies was current in astronomy. So, and sometimes even our solar system is called a universe. Okay, life goes on. I hope there will be no more interruptions. So it can be a solar system, a planet, as they are true of the tiny creations of a chela. The rules of magic are universal in our universe. The rules for magic are universal in our universe. From the greatest to the tiniest. Okay. Now, the first reaction of the average student on reading the above is to think immediately of the body nature as it expresses some type of energy. Thus, duality is the thing noted, and that which employs the thing is present in his mind. So we have, you know, the first reaction is to, what should we say, thinking of the pairs of opposites. Yet one of the main necessities before occult aspirants at this time is the endeavor to think in terms of the one reality, which is energy itself and nothing else. So let's consider In this context, let's consider being and energy as the same. Because, well, I guess being is maybe even a purer idea, but as being acts, okay, as being acts, it becomes energy. These are subtle matters. Therefore, it is of value to emphasize in our discussions of this abstruse subject, indeed, the fact that spirit and energy are synonymous terms and are interchangeable. Okay, so now we can add the term spirit as equivalent to energy. Okay, it's equivalent to energy and being. Right. So interchangeable. Understanding of the world of active phenomena in which we are surrounded and in which we move. So we have spirit and energy are synonymous terms, and something's been cut out. So it's necessary, unfortunately, to go back. This is the reason we don't want to be interrupted, you know. Spirit and energy are synonymous. Spirit and energy are, and let's see if that's enough. Yes, spirit and energy are synonymous terms and are interchangeable. Only in this realization, and I'll just copy this whole thing here. You can always tell when something's missing, and, you know, maybe one has done it oneself. Only in this realization, or in the realization of this, can we arrive at the reconciliation of science and religion, and at a true understanding of the world of active phenomena by which we are surrounded and in which we move. So, you know, in my way of thinking, being is, just a little ruffle there. So let's say, being is primary, and spirit and energy are being in action. We can say it is also possible that being, spelled this way, will never be in action. And then we would have such a term as be-ness or absoluteness. Blavatsky emphasizes the idea that the absolute does not act, and yet something always seems to emerge from it. Okay. Well, hopefully we can move along now. The terms organic and inorganic are largely responsible for much of the confusion. This is, let's just say, against the theory of hylozoism. And the sharp differentiation existing in the minds of many people between body and spirit, between life and form, let's just say rather, say, rather Descartesian, have led to a refusal to admit the essential identity in nature of these two, as Blavatsky brings forward for us that that life, well, let's see, how does he, spirit and matter are identical, and soul is included within them, or this triplicity is of one substance, really, and that substance is life, which pervades them all. Maybe Cartesian is the word. Okay, I think it is. The world in which we live is regarded by the majority as really solid and tangible, yet possessing some mysterious power lying concealed within it, which produces movement, activity, and change. This, of course, is putting it crudely, but it suffices to sum up the unintelligent attitude. So the idea of density is conceived by rather dense and undeveloped minds, he's telling us, that the world is somehow solid. Well, you know, even from the times of the Greeks and much earlier, there was an investigation into the constituents of matter, but only for the few, by the few. This, of course, is putting it crudely, but it suffices to sum up the unintelligent attitude. We're trying to end these hard and fast dualities in the state of mind. The Orthodox scientist is largely occupied with structures, relationships, with the composition of form, and with the activity produced by the component form parts and their interrelations and dependencies, the chemicals and elements and the functions and parts they play, and their mutual interactions as they compose all forms in all kingdoms of nature. And all these are the subject of their investigation. The nature of the atom, the molecule, and the cell, their functions, the qualities of their force, manifestations, and the varying types of activity, the solving of the problem as to the character and nature of the energies, focalized or localized in the differing forms of the natural or material world, demand consideration of the ablest minds in the world of thought. So this is a wonderful, let's call this a, we'll call this a summary of the pursuits of the modern scientist. Well, I'm sure we recognize, as DK is describing it, how the scientist operates. But, you know, there's a wonderful section in the Law of Repulse where we talk about the garment of God, and then we talk about the one behind the garment who uses the garment, and it keeps on telling the disciple to find me, know me, the true being behind the garment. So then, DK goes on a little bit in that vein. But that's found, you know, in the Law of Repulse and Esoteric Psychology too. Yet the questions, what is life, what is energy, or what is the process of becoming and the nature of being, remain unanswered. I keep on hoping for the ability not to do that. These are philosophical / scientific questions, but mostly philosophical, you know, about the nature of ultimate reality. I don't think that any scientist of the present kind can address himself to that question. But these remain unanswered. The problem as to the why and the wherefore is regarded as fruitless and speculative and almost insoluble. So they don't take that area as their province, but we do remember that Master R, who was, or Francis Bacon, when he was Francis Bacon, was so inspiring to the scientific mind, took all knowledge as his province. So the philosophical, the scientific, the organizational, all of this, the range of his knowledge is very great. And he signaled that even in the days before he was the Mahachohan, when he was Francis Bacon. Nevertheless, to the pure reason and through the correct functioning of the intuition, these problems can be solved and these questions answered. So what would we say? You know that, I guess I know what I'd say, that, well, they're not inclined to go that way, but scientists give up too early and consider insoluble that which can be solved, well, at least to a degree. The solution is one of the ordinary revelations and attainments of initiation, at least the solution up to a point, because we realize that even our planetary logos, even our solar logos, stand in ignorance with regard to many things that are operating in the wider universe. And I wonder if the nature of unveiled being, although contacted in some small measure, even by the human being, can be discovered by such logoi as planetary and solar, or even galactic. I wonder if that unveiled truth about the nature of being must not await the return of all emanated entities into the universal logoic state. Anyway, initiation reveals much. The only true biologists are the initiates of the mysteries, for they have an understanding of life and its purpose, and are so identified with the life principle that they think and speak in terms of energy and its effects. So here again, the correlation of life and energy. They speak of in terms of its effects, the planetary hierarchy. Let's see if I've gotten this correct. The only true biologists, they're so identified with the life principle that they think and speak in terms of energy and its effects. Well, I think we're going to have to go here again because I seem to be erasing certain things, and there always is a little delay when that happens, for which, for which I apologize. Okay, well, I finally got that straightened out. So the solution is one of the ordinary attainments of initiation, and the only true biologists are the initiates of mysteries. Why? For they have an understanding of life and its purpose, and are so identified with the life principle that they think and speak in terms of energy and its effects, and all their activities in connection with the work of the planetary hierarchy are based on a few fundamental formulas which concern life and which make itself felt, and which life as it makes itself felt through its three differentiations or aspects, energy, force, and matter. So I think that puts things in the proper perspective. Okay. And we just say that initiates are the true biologists. The true biologists thinking ever in terms of life are the initiates. Okay, and they have it all boiled down to a few clear fundamentals which are not yet in our possession, but if we can begin to think in terms of energy, force, and matter, they will come into our possession. So we have to go behind the garment of God to life itself, expressing itself as energy, force, and matter. And we need to discover the true identity who is wearing the garment. Otherwise, we will forever be satisfied pursuing questions regarding the form, and we will forget the great questions of how that form came into being and what its purpose may be. So, it should be noted that only as a man understands himself can he arrive at an understanding of that which is the sum total we call God. So it's a sort of an adaptation of the Delphic injunction, know thyself, and thou shalt know the world. Of course, some people consider that particular kind of psychological inquiry to be maybe a waste of time and part of the soft sciences and not real, but the law of analogy holds. This is a truism and an occult platitude. We have to change our truisms and occult platitudes into individual realizations. But when acted upon, leads to a revelation which makes the present unknown God a recognized reality. So, you know, the occultist looks for the hidden being responsible for the hidden causes, which lie both of them behind and within the world of effects. Let me illustrate, he says. Man knows himself to be a living being and calls death that mysterious process wherein that something which he commonly designates as the breath of life is withdrawn. On its withdrawal, the form disintegrates. The cohesive vitalizing force is gone, and this produces that falling apart into its essential elements of that which has hitherto been regarded as the body. Well, and even this presentation is rather advanced. The life principle, the basic essential of being, and this mysterious elusive factor is the correspondence in man of that which we call spirit or life in the macrocosm. Both are a kind of breath of life. Just as the man in the life in man holds together, animates, vitalizes, and drives into activity the form, and so makes of him a living being, so the life of God, as the Christian calls it, performs the same purpose in the universe and produces that coherent, living, vital ensemble, which we call a solar system or any universal structure. So the breath is the life, and the breath holds the form together, and with the withdrawal of the breath comes the disintegration of that which was held in coherence by the breath. So this life principle in man is manifest in a triple manner as the, All right, the life principle. So let's just say the threefold manifestation of the life principle. All right, what is it? It manifests as the directional will, purpose, basic incentive. That's number one. Okay. And this is the dynamic energy which sets the being functioning, brings him into existence, sets the term of his life. This first ray potency determines beginnings and endings, carries him through the years. You know, the will to go on, the will to live, long or short, and abstracts itself at the close of the life cycle. This is the spirit, and let's remember that, let's just see, the word spirit is related to breath, spirare, to breathe. This is the spirit in man manifesting as the will to live, to be, to act, to pursue, to evolve. This is the spirit in man breathing and sustaining the life in form. In its lowest aspect, it works through the mental body or nature, and in connection with the dense physical makes itself felt through the brain. Okay. So it must have some higher points or concentrations through which it works. Okay. So this threefold manifestation of the life principle, we might call this thinking of the kind of motion that's involved, driving forward through space. That is a first ray motion. And there's another phrase which right now I'm forgetting, but it's an important one, and it has to do with the way, the type of motion demonstrated by the first ray. Next is the coherent force, and the law of cohesion is found here, and it relates to the second ray and to Jupiter, even as the first one relates to the hammer stroke, which sets things in motion, driving them forward, hammer stroke of Vulcan. It manifests as the coherent force. It is that significant essential quality which makes each man different. So we call it quality. And the second ray, which produces that complex manifestation of moods, desires, qualities, complexes, inhibitions, feelings, and characteristics, which produce a man's peculiar psychology. So the mixture of many qualities produce all these. This is the result of the interplay between spirit or energy aspect and the matter aspect. You know, this is God the Son, this is the soul, this is the consciousness, and we know that soul, the sun, The love principle arises from the interplay of father, mother, spirit, and matter. This is the distinctive, he uses words so well, noticed as different from others, thus distinct and distinctive in its quality. This is the distinctive subjective man, his coloring, as color and quality and tone, they all go together. His coloring or individual note, this it is which sets the rate of vibratory activity of his body, produces his particular type of form, is responsible for the condition and nature of his organs, his glands, and his outer aspect. This is the soul in its lowest aspect. And in its lowest aspect, it works through the emotional or astral nature and in connection with the dense physical through the heart. So this is the second. Okay, this is the what should we call it? The second of the triple ways, which the life, by means of which the life principle manifests. Threefold manifestation of the life principle, this factor of coherence, the driving will, and coherence. So, let's just say, thus far we have this. Thus far, we have the driving, compelling will, and the factor of coherence. I wonder if I use the term driving forward through space, if I'll find the other term. Oh, onward progressive motion. I believe that's it. Ah, that's it. Okay. Driving forward through space, or the energy of progress onward. Okay. And here is our friend coherence, hopefully spelled correctly. Now, the third of the ways in which the life principle manifests, the activity of the atoms and cells with which the physical body is composed, but of course there are other types of atoms and cells in the subtle vehicles, but I think I want to emphasize the word activity, because this is the activity aspect, the third aspect, to which we are still, as human beings, very subject. Okay. So this is the activity of the atoms and cells of which the physical body is composed. It is the sum total of those little lives of which the human organs comprising the entire man are composed. These have a life of their own and a consciousness which is strictly individual, though not individualized, and identified. This aspect of the life principle works through the etheric or vital body, and in connection with the solid mechanism of the tangible form, the spleen. So I think what we've had so far, we've had heart and spleen. And brain. We've had brain, heart, and spleen. Okay. So thus far the physical points through which this life principle works are the brain, heart, and spleen. We can't call it the mind, we have to call it the organ of the heart. The organ of the brain. And we're not dealing with chakras right now. These are actual physical organs. Okay. So, and this should be number two and not number one. Set the numbering value at two. Okay. And let's see what happens. Yeah, number three comes in. So, in three ways, there is a manifestation of the life principle. It's in the vehicles, mind, emotions and body, and brain, heart and spleen. So let me put those down. Brain, heart, and spleen, these are physical organs, and the vehicles involved are mind, emotion, and etheric body, with the dense physical body responding, accordingly, according to that which drives it. Now 1 hour has passed. Okay, friends, so what I'm going to do about that, I do have a program again tonight in just an hour and 10 minutes from now, so maybe I'll go on for another half hour or so and see if after the broadcast on the reappearance of the Christ, we have to keep these meditations going, whether I can come back and do a bit more. I would like somehow to finish for you before I have to go up to the Little Bear Meditation Center. Don't want to dare call it the Great Bear. We have seven little wooden bears around, and hopefully they will remain attached to the building instead of wandering off in the hands of those who admire them. So I would like to make all of these programs about the rules for magic on the astral plane available to you. Plenty to study, years worth to study. I've been studying the Tibetan now for 47 years, and have been a little bit aware of it before that. 47 years, I think that's accurate. Since 1971. And this is 2018. So in 2021, it will be 50 years. And truthfully and honestly, just scratching the surface, but optimistic that what man has done, man can do. And thinking about what the Christ said in relation to the accomplishments of those who followed him and to his disciples, greater things shall ye do than I do. So the door is open. 1 hour. Okay. It is not, of course, possible to give the mantric words and phrases which are mentioned in Rule 11. They would be profoundly incomprehensible to all but the initiate, and therefore need not engross our attention. It should be noted that much in these instructions is in advance of modern thought, and both these instructions and the treatise on cosmic fire will be only fully understood towards the end of the century. Well, this to me looks like optimism. I suppose it's always my thought. The atomic bomb proved much and set the schedule back, because then the possibility existed that man might indeed destroy the whole experiment of creating the human race. So, I can't imagine these 15 rules for magic as they are presented in this book and in the treatise on cosmic fire being really understood. I can imagine that initiates can understand them, but as far as even the intelligent man goes, I think not, you know. But then again, you know, one can always be incorrect, and maybe there's much more understanding of these things that I presently credit. But what I've seen so far is there has been perhaps some delay in understanding what has been given and the Christ who might have appeared in person in Mayavarupa before the end of the last century will now be delayed, I think. You know, we can't really say, but a century or two, certain things have to be accomplished before he can come on that great wave of expectation. So anyway, now we're into a new section here, and let's see what it offers us. I can do a little more now, only a little more. Let us consider this rule sentence by sentence and arrive at that one of the interpretations which is the easiest for the average aspirant. And he really tells us, you know, please do consider yourself to be the average aspirant, because really you are no more. All these rules can be read from the standpoint of intelligent man and will mean but little. They can be read from the standpoint of the aspirant and will then convey certain practical ideas which are susceptible of daily application and can be wrought out in the crucible of life experience. But of course, you know, others can get still more out of them. They will mean but little. They can be read by the aspirant and they can prove to be a practical guide, you know. They will achieve meaning as the aspirant learns to handle energies, to work in mental matter, and to cooperate creatively with the purpose underlying the evolutionary plan. From the angle of vision of the disciple, these rules carry certain potent instructions and will lead him to an understanding of the process of the creative work in nature, which is necessarily sealed to the mind of the aspirant. Well, certainly the true disciple here is at least an initiate of the first degree, because he tells us that the true aspirant is an initiate of the first degree. So maybe we're talking about what the accepted disciple can understand. The book will mean different things at different depths to people of different attainment and training. As to the comprehension of the initiate, these words convey definite commands which only his illumined intuition can rightly interpret. So we have several types of understanding here, from incomprehension even by the intelligent to practical approaches which can be worked out and discovered, or more can be discovered about them by the aspirant, and then instructions to the disciple and commands to the initiate. And let's just say we have here lack of comprehension. We have, we have practical ideas conveyed. We have instruction and commands, depending on the attainment of the one who reads this book. With the higher grades of intelligences, we need not concern ourselves. Perhaps they have application. I mean, he's told us that the rules of magic on their can be applied on various levels, maybe very high levels, that the process is always the same in certain respects. It's just that much more has to be taken into consideration by the higher grades of intelligences who may wish to work with a higher application of these rules. With the higher grades of intelligences, we need not concern ourselves. We will consider this rule, therefore, solely from the angle of vision of the average aspirant, leaving other interpretations to those individuals who have the internal equipment which will enable them to understand. So I guess he's saying, if you are a disciple, you have to deal with the instructions given. And attempt to achieve the deepest understanding possible to you. He seems to be saying that. Okay, so now we have some sentences which must be interpreted. Okay, so let's make them big so they stand out. And the three things the disciple must do, or the worker in the magical art must do, or let's find out who must do what. The worker with the law must now accomplish, ascertain the formula which will confine the lives within the ensphering wall. Ascertain the formula which will confine the lives within the ensphering wall, and remember that to ascertain is to arrive at certainty. All forms in nature, as we well know, are made up of myriads of tiny lives, holding a certain measure of awareness, of rhythm, and of coherency according to the force of the law of attraction utilized by the builders of the form. I think I want to, you know, read that again. Okay. So, all forms in nature as we well know are made up of myriads of tiny lives holding a certain measure of awareness, of rhythm, and of coherency according to the force of the law of attraction utilized by the builders of the form. So this is true of the tiny lives. That's what I wanted to determine. This is true both of the macrocosm and of the infinite world of microcosmic lives. I mean, we're too many to count, I guess, is what we're really saying. And infinite is infinite, and it's uncountable. You can start counting, but you'll never end. So this is true both of the macrocosm and of the infinite world of microcosmic lives, which are contained within the greater whole. Embryo solar systems coming into being under the impulse of divine thought are at first fluidic and nebulous, are shifting in outline, and are held together loosely by a central nucleus of energy, another way of expressing the embodied idea. So, you know, all the way from the very tiniest to the very, some of the very largest, the same principle holds, the central life holds it all together, according to the law of attraction. All forms in nature, as are well known, are made up of myriads of tiny lives, and it's either the tiny lives of the forms that are holding a certain measure of awareness. Of course, the tiny lives do. They also have their certain rhythm, I suppose, under the law of vibration. And they're also holding a certain coherency according to the powers of attraction existing between them. And that will, of course, affect the entirety of the form. Okay, so this is true both of the macrocosm and the many, many lives. Embryo solar systems are, you know, at first fluidic. I suppose we can notice this astronomically if we know what to look for, but they're all held together by a central nucleus of energy. As time progresses, they pass on to other conditions, the many lives that are held, I suppose, the solar systems, and they take a more definite form. They enter into peculiar relations with allied and neighboring forms. I'm thinking about planets as comets, you know, and how gradually they settle down and probably adjust their revolutions around a central nucleus. At first, comets have very various orbits, and they are not settling into the kinds of revolutions, orbital revolutions we now have for the planets, which they have become. They enter into peculiar relations with allied and neighboring forms and adjust themselves to various relations of an internal nature with those forms, which in the earlier stage was not possible. So this is second. Yeah. So this is the second stage. And there is reduction of erratic movement and a settling. Eventually, we find a solar system such as ours and myriads of others, a solar system functioning as a sun with its revolving and rotating planets, preserving their different orbits, holding their stated and relative positions, active as independent and interdependent organisms, and yet presenting to the eye of the astronomer a coherence, a unity, and a structure that is unique in each case and yet which functions under cosmic law. So this is the third stage, that of a recognizable solar system. Okay, but it starts out in a somewhat fluidic, nebular configuration and gradually densifies and articulates and becomes better defined in terms of its motions. It measures up a solar system and its logos, measures up to some vast purpose, conceived and held steadily in the universal mind. Let's call it the universal mind of the solar logos, of a solar logos, which is in its turn an aspect of that group conscious and self-conscious entity who is the author of its being and the creator of its form. So the solar system, any solar system eventually responds to the will and intention of a solar logos, and thus it goes for cosmic logoi and supercosmic logoi, eventually onto the galactic level and so forth. There's always going to be some logos embodying an aggregation of lesser lives that are held within an ensphering wall by the will of the creator and by the coherency factor applied by that creator. So thus it is, even in our own tiny little micro cosmic system, you know, it's there are many, many lives held in relationship to each other by that central will, which we are, and by the law of attraction as it operates through that centrality, which we are. So it can be a man, it can be a planetary logos, solar logos, and on, the principles are the same. A central life holds all the lesser lives in coherence. So, oopsie. Okay, sometimes forget what I've done. Yeah. So, A, oh, come on, a central life holds all lesser lives it has gathered magnetically in coherence within a certain ring pass knot, the ensphering wall. The ensphering wall, sorry, is a ring pass knot. N-S-P-H-E-R-E-A-R. Oh, well, I'm not sure how that's spelled, but I'll just do it this way and hope for the best. All right. This one intelligent life may be posited as creating in his meditation, or its, if you prefer, for what do words matter when all is futile to express reality as it is? We might say that this this is the Tibetan's sacrifice and frustration. He has to spend a lot of time using a medium of expression which is inadequate to the task of expression. So, what do the words matter? It's, her, his, you know. But, you know, these days we look for many terms to be gender neutral, and we can't really say of a great logos that it's only a him or only a her. All of these polarities are united within it, and sometimes the word it covers the uniting of the polarities, or at least does not emphasize one polarity or another. Unless there is a good reason to do so, as in the masculine incarnation of our planetary logos and the feminine incarnation of Venus at this time. So this one intelligent life, capital L, may be posited as creating in his meditation, or its if you prefer, for what do words matter when all is futile to express reality as it is. As creating in his meditation and consequently in his reflective mind that which we call a thought form. This thought form has four major characteristics. So every conscious creator, great or small, creates a thought form. This is not the unconscious approach where anything might come out through habit. Number one, so four main characteristics. Let's take a look here. Okay. It is brought into being through the conscious use of the law of attraction. It's something, the materials of the thought form have to be assembled. Let's just say the materials of the thought form have to be assembled. It is formed of an infinite number. A very large number. It is formed of an infinite number of living entities who are attracted by the mind of the divine creator and thus enter into relation with each other. So each of the many little lives, relatively, is attracted by the divine creator and enters its magnetic field and thus relates to many other similar little lives. Then the form is the externalization of something the creator has visualized, built intelligently and colored or qualified so as to meet the purpose for which it was intended, vitalized by the potency of his desire and the strength of his living thought, held in shape as long as it is needed in order to perform its specific work. And we might say that this is an act of will, connected to himself by a magnetic thread, the thread of his living purpose and the strength of his dominant will. So here we have a practical recapitulation of the MGL, the magical process. In order to create a form. Okay, four main characteristics. Law of attraction is one. The constituent lives are assembled. Number two, they come towards and go into the sphere of influence of the creating entity. They are attracted by the mind of the creator and thus enter into relation not only with him, but with the other smaller units so attracted. The form is the externalization, is the externalization. And here are of what process, and a process which has been visualized and qualified and vitalized and held and connected to the creator and so forth. And this thought form has what? Four main characteristics. This interior purpose, which has clothed itself in mental, astral, and vital substance, is potent on the physical plane, where it has precipitated, just as long as it remains consciously in its creator's thought. So keep your mind on it, you know. I had a friend who said, well, you know, Mike, when you think about it, everything hangs together, and if you take your attention away, it doesn't. There was maybe a little truth in it, but some thought forms must achieve that kind of independence that they can go on in perpetuity, or at least in good form, without the constant attention of the creator. As I use the Beethoven analogy, let's just say Beethoven is dead now, But he and he's not looking in at every performance of his Fifth Symphony. It's out there on its own, and thus it is for Bach and other great creators. They have released it maybe before death, or certainly after, I would guess. So it's going to be potent on the physical plane as long as it's in the creator's thought. And this represents an earlier stage than one that follows release or severing of the creation from the creator. It keeps its distance, if all is well, occultly from its creator. Many thought forms remain futile as they are too close to their creator, and others cannot use such forms or interpret them. You know, it's kind of interesting, keeping up the analogy here, or at least the example of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. How many different conductors have their own method of interpreting, that great symphony? I sometimes think, and I listen to maybe the inferior sound quality of a recording made in the 1950s, but when I hear Toscanini conduct Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, I am excited, as I am with no other interpreter. And you hear all kinds of interpretations, all kinds of tempos and dynamics, you know, the loud and soft and so forth. So anyway, it keeps its distance from the creator occultly, maybe, or it should. Or the creator should make sure that it does. And as I say, not hold it too close, otherwise he will suffocate. You know, the analogy is there. You have a child, but you bind the child. It's sort of a feminine analogy to your apron strings, so the child is never free to go and be itself. It can be directed in any desired direction and under the law of least resistance, can find its own place, thus performing its desired function and carrying out the purpose for which it was created. And so it will be vital on the physical form, on the physical plane, as long as it can find its own place. It can be vital if it can find its own place. The formula, therefore, might be regarded as the idea emanating from the thinker. It might be defined as the dynamic purpose, the thing, as the thinker sees it and externalizes it in his mind and visualizes it as the carrier of his intent. The mathematics which underlie the construction of a bridge, such as any of the great spans which signalize human achievement, convey not to the uninitiated, but to those who know and understand they are the bridge itself reduced to its essential terms. They are the bridge in latency. See, it's a good analogy, really. And in these mathematical formulas lie hid the purpose, the quality, and the form of the completed structure and its eventual usefulness. So it is with the concepts and the ideas which give birth to a thought form. So, you know, there is the formula underlying the evident form. These occult formulas exist on the archetypal plane. I think they are when we talk about the archetypes in the mind of God, mathematics has something big to play in the creation of an archetype. These occult formulas exist on the archetypal plane, which for the aspirant is the plane of the intuition, though in reality it is a state of far higher still, and we might say on the cosmic physical plane it is ultimately logoic. These formulas underlie a world of forms and must be contacted by those who are duly equipped to work under the great architect of the universe. It's a name of the great third ray lord in Shambhala. There are, symbolically speaking, three great books of formulas. Goodness, he's giving us some of the truths having to do with the higher creativity. Note the words, symbolically speaking, and forget them not, because we're not necessarily talking about tomes that we can open, but aggregations of formulas which are found together and which have a certain similarity. There is first the Book of Life, read and eventually mastered by initiates of all degrees. There is the Book of Divine Wisdom, read by aspirants of all degrees, sometimes called the Book of Knowing Experience. And there is the Book of Forms, which is compulsory reading for all in whom the intelligence is awakening to functioning activity. It's early on, you know, early man, primitive man, contacts the forms and learns from them. It is with the Book of Forms that we are now concerned. And I think these books are also referenced in esoteric astrology, but here maybe a little more is said, and if we combine what is said there with what is said here, we'll have an idea of these symbolic collections of formulas. There is first the Book of Life, read and eventually mastered by all initiates, by initiates of all degrees. It will consist of the true energy formulation which creates ultimately the form. There is the Book of Wisdom, read by all aspirants. How shall these formulas be applied wisely and in line with the plan? So the Book of Divine Wisdom, read by aspirants of all degrees, is connected with the second aspect of divinity, sometimes called the Book of Knowing Experience. We gather, we harvest wisdom from the attempt to apply what we think we know. And then the Book of Forms, we run into the forms and we cannot escape them, and it's compulsory reading for all of us. Just because we want certain forms to change or go away or be modified, it will not be possible just because we want it to be so. Patanjali speaks in one place of the rain cloud of knowable things, of which the soul is consciously aware. The aspirant, weary of the eternal round of his own futile and unimportant thoughts, seeks to tap the resources of this rain cloud and so precipitate upon earth some of the thoughts of God. He seeks to work so that he can further the manifestation of the ideas of the Creator, which would be, you know, the manifestation of the divine plan. And to do this, he has to fulfill certain requirements, which might be stated as possible. So, as follows. So, if we want to precipitate the divine plan by working with the rain cloud of noble things, that's one that really should be there, isn't it? Rain cloud of noble things. And there's also of unknowable things. Rain cloud of knowable things. Okay. If we want to precipitate the divine plan by working with the rain cloud of knowable things, I made a mistake. Sorry. Rain cloud of knowable things. And I'm going to have to do it again. Rain, cloud of knowable things. And there is the quotation mark. Replace, yes, yes, and okay. Okay. What must the creator do? Certain requirements, certain initial requirements, and always more requirements are added later as we progress. Know the true meaning of meditation. Align with facility, the soul, the mind, the brain. Contemplate or function as the soul on its own plane. It then becomes possible for the soul to act as the intermediary between the plane of divine ideas and the mental plane. So, Buddhic, okay. The plane of wisdom and the mental plane. So, focus as the intermediary soul on its own plane. And this means the higher mental plane at first. Really, the plane of the solar angel is the Buddhic plane minimally, and who knows how much higher it may be able to focus, as it has already been on the cosmic astral plane. So you see how this matter of participation in the divine creative process works out as the objective of all true meditation work. So, meditate to become spiritually and divinely creative in line with the divine plan. And another requirement, register the idea received by the soul intuitively and recognize the form it should take. These last seven words are of vital importance because, you know, we can register the idea and then have that idea descend into illusion. Number five, in other words, clothe it improperly so that it has little use and cannot be recognized. And what could be a good presence among human beings turns out to be ignored because it just can't be recognized or dealt with or related to. Reduce the vague and misty idea to its essentials, discarding all vain imaginings and the formulations of the lower mind, so equipping oneself to leap readily into activity and through steadfastness in contemplation, receive accurately the vision of the inner structure, or the subjective skeleton, if I may so term it, of the form which is to be. And this is what we call reception of the blueprints. So, and all this is a clarification. Number six. Okay. What about number six? So basically, he's saying, if we want to manifest the ideas of the creator, he has to have some initial requirements. Meditate, know the true meaning of meditation. So I don't know, do I need to emphasize these? align, contemplate, and of course, the true white magician being an initiate of the third degree, he can function as the soul on its own plane, not just in the concrete mind as a receiver of soul, impress, register. I'm just looking at the verbs here, and recognize the form which it should take. As I say, the bad clothing of a good idea is one of the real factors involved with illusion. Reduce, yes, and finally, so the blueprint is there. This, as recorded consciously by the soul upon the mind, is as consciously registered by the mind, held steady in the light, and might be regarded as the reduction of the formula or to the blueprint. Might be regarded, there we have it. The formula is probably pretty obscure for the likes of us, but maybe the blueprint can be worked out. It is not the formula itself, but the secondary process, according to the strength, the simplicity, that's important, as is related to Shambhala and the will, and a clear presentation of the archetype, according to the strength, the simplicity, and the clarity of the embodiment of the formula in a simple outline structure, so will be the finally furnished building, Masonic terms here, and the consequent form, which will confine within the periphery of the outer form itself the lives used in its construction. These are detailed points. They are clear points. This, as recorded consciously by the soul upon the mind, is as consciously registered by the mind, held steady in the light. So let's just say both soul and mind are acutely conscious in this process. Well, friends, I would go on to the two-hour mark, but I cannot because there's a broadcast coming up. So I just have to stop this, regretfully. I simply must. And be ready then for the broadcast. And let's see where we are. Or is it 1 hour? I sometimes am losing track here. We've begun Rule 11. Anyway, that's the point. And it's 11.1, and we're going to go on to 11.2. You can see how detailed and abstruse some of these instructions are. And how much repetition might be needed for assimilation. Our goal, let us remember, in all of this press forward is assimilation as much as possible before the year 2025. So this is the 54th program, and it's not Rule 10, it's Rule 11, and it's 1101, chapter 11 and point 1, and from 445 to something to 457, 445 to 457, and it's occurring on the 13th of September, and then we'll go on to number 55. If you spell out Sanat, you'll get 55. Rules for magic on the astral plane, it's 11.2, and we're starting from 450 7. And who knows what day it will be, whether it will be today or not, I cannot be sure. Okay, well, you know, I always want to go back and somehow, maybe the crab, you know, my rising sign, wants to go back and confirm. But at least we know something now about inner requirements for those who want to further through the creative process the divine plan and to be involved in the precipitation of the rain cloud of noble things. Let us say, rain cloud of noble things. Where are we? Okay. Well, anyway, here it is, I think. Right. Which the soul can access far more easily than the personality. And thus we must be centered as soul to successfully do so. All right. C-E-N-T-E-R-E-D. That's it. All right, friends. I got to rush now. Well, I don't want to admit to rushing, but I must hurry on. We'll see you soon. And thank you for listening and participating. We'll do a bit more later.